I would say just one thing that, you know, I say to students or others or anybody who'll listen, and that is if you stick with something long enough, then one of the things that gives you optimism is remembering what you saw before and seeing that it's addressed.
Hey everyone, Frank here. In this episode, we have the incredible privilege of having Ophelia Dahl and Dr. Paul Farmer from Partners in Health on the show. But before we start the interview, I want to let you know about our latest giveaway. Right now, you can sign up for a chance to win a truly terrific book called Keep Going by Austin Kleon. I have quoted this book so many times, I've lost count. And it's one of those books that you'll have to read with a pencil in hand because you'll be underlining sentences and making notes in the margin. We're giving away 50 copies, plus one grand prize winner will get three of Austin's books, plus 10 books he says inspired his thinking. Go to crazygoodturns.org/keep going. That's all one word, no spaces, keep going. So go and sign up, and if you don't win, what the hell? Buy the book, it's fantastic. Okay, now on with the show. Today we have the privilege, and it truly is a privilege, to talk with two remarkable people, Ophelia Dahl and Paul Farmer. Many of you, I suspect, already know of them. They are the founders of Partners in Health, a worldwide enterprise whose mission is to transform global health one patient at a time. There have been many articles and books written about them. There is a documentary soon to be released about them called Bending the Arc. And Partners in Health is one of the rare nonprofits started within the last few decades that has reached real scale. They've helped nearly 4 million patients through over 200 healthcare facilities in several countries, from Indian reservations here in the U.S. to Haiti, Sierra Leone, Kazakhstan, to name just a few. Ophelia is chair of Partners in Health and has been since 2003. And Paul, in addition to co-founding Partners in Health, is a physician and anthropologist and a professor and chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. I don't want to use up all of our time listing their accomplishments. I could do that. But instead, I'll just say, Ophelia and Paul, welcome to today's show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Terrific to be here. Thank you, Frank.
So let me start by asking you to take our listeners on your journey as founders of Partners in Health. What started you on the path, and when did you realize it was a path you were committed to?
We met in 1983, and I had gone there to volunteer when I was 18 and wanted to see a different part of the world and wanted to buy some time, not quite knowing what I wanted to do. And I had been there for just a few months when I met Paul, and it was instant click, instant soulmate kind of situation. And we started a conversation, and really that same day that went well into the night and early morning. And I would say that it's really a conversation we've had ever since, and the conversation has just brought more and more people into it. But I think that the sense of going to a place that rearranges the way that you think about the world, or the way that you had thought the world was, it's an important moment for anyone. And I think that plenty of people, I imagine, have those moments. I think the difference was for me that I was introduced to Paul and a group of people, and it felt as though I wanted to just apply myself in some way to be connected to those people and to do work together.
That's pretty much it for me as well.
You had more of a plan. I think it's fair to say. When I talked to you about what we could do about the work, you were 23 and you said, well, if we do these things first and then these things, I think vision is a good thing.
Well, I mean, I had 5 years on you. I hadn't started medical school, and that year or so in Haiti was utterly transformational. I was ready to be transformed. I had grown up in rural Florida. I, you know, the province of the healthy. And from a big family, we didn't think about healthcare delivery or health insurance or. And I knew I wanted to be a doctor. I'm not sure I knew why, but that year in between college and medical school changed me profoundly.
So I suspect, though, that a lot of people might start medical school thinking, I'm going to use this for a deeper purpose and greater good, or spend, as in your case, Ophelia, spend a year or some time in a country like Haiti, but then return to a more well-trodden path. What do you think was it that kept you on the path, that made the path so compelling that you committed to it? Or was that something embedded in yourselves from the start?
I as a medical professor to now, as opposed to a medical student, I'm quite struck by how many medical students come in with those convictions, but I'm also struck by how many are able to sustain those convictions over time. I think that it's a different narrative than saying, well, young people come into medical school or nursing school or whatever with a lot of convictions and then they dissipate over time. That really has not been my experience, whether teaching medical school students and nursing students here or in Haiti or in Rwanda. It's how do you build a community to keep those convictions alive? And the conviction I'm referring to is, you know, wanting to do something meaningful and good for others, in this case, particularly people who are ill or injured. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of it. I don't know that we were particularly exceptional.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that, Frank. But I also think, as someone who didn't go to medical school, that there's, you know, the staying with it, and we think about this, not because we think about leaving, but as Paul once said to me, or answered a question of someone who said, you know, how do you stay in this? And Paul said, you don't leave. It's really something I turn to all the time. And it, obviously you can apply it to all kinds of other facets of life. But I think that the idea, there are a couple of ingredients, right? The idea that you go somewhere as an 18-year-old and you go there to sort of see and learn, and if you're lucky, to make friends. But then when there's a suggestion that, you know, you can do something to affect some change, even in a small way, you have to have been socialized to feel as though you can do something like that, which is, you know, obviously something we've all been socialized for, a level of success. And you know, that means just bringing a kind of an attitude, really, of sort of can do. It doesn't mean plowing through and saying, you know, I know the answers, obviously, but it does mean saying, like, when someone says, well, we need to raise some money, it's like, well, I think I can do that. Or we need to fix or find a set of supplies, like, I think I can do that. And then when you have some incremental, and usually, certainly at the beginning, relatively small successes in this as a team, it's pretty infectious to feel as though you know, and so, I mean, I think if you only face barrier after barrier, it's probably a little bit more difficult to stay in the game, but that's another reason to do it with people you trust and love and like working with, because, you know, as you get tired or you get dispirited, then, you know, people lift you up. So I think there's all kinds of ingredients that go into this.
There's a great quote, and I think I've got this right from you, Ophelia, that the quote goes something like, imagination allows you to make the link between the near of your lives with the distant others. And listening to you, I'm suspecting that there are pivotal stories or stories, people that had an impact on you that help you to sustain that optimism. Who are some of those people, or what are some of those stories?
I go back to the time when I first went to Haiti, and I spent the first few months, actually, you know, really kind of, I lived at a school for handicapped children and in the city, in Port-au-Prince, and then I would go out on these outreach trips for an ophthalmic organization. So I truly was just listening and watching and thinking about, you know, how things could be different. I feel as though I got to know people in a much deeper way and understand the history and the socio-political economy of the region. You know, we did a deep, deep dive. I can remember the name of someone that I haven't spoken to or heard from, which is unusual because we're in touch, but he was already an older man. I'm thinking about a guy called Absalom Kola. And he was, at that point, an older man, probably not as old as I thought he was because, you know, people who've lived a you know, really hard life look a lot, 40-year-olds look a lot like 75-year-olds in those circumstances. But we sat down and talked to him, and he told and recounted the story of losing his land in the 50s and having to choose, because they heard that there was this dam being, well, they heard and saw the dam being built. They heard their land was going to be flooded. They were thinking, how are they going to flood the land? I got my house here. I got my land here. I got my fields and crops. And sure enough, I mean, he told us the day that they started to flood his livelihood and run up the mountainside and decide whether to choose to carry a pig or a goat, and charging up the hillside with his kids. Those are the kinds of stories that are a tremendously powerful foundation.
This is in a particular place, Frank. It was a squatter settlement that was established really because the valley was flooded. But when we went there, long time after that event, but people carry these memories of having known something better. Some of the young people we worked with, the gentleman that Ophelia mentioned has passed on, but at least, you know, he survived to a ripe old age. We also work with people who were more or less our own age. Three of them who were working with us directly died before their 30th birthday. And I can say that, you know, those were my first real experiences with grief and even death. Those were harrowing, and, you know, those stick with you. And in our case, because we were a community of folks that was growing, because most were Haitian, there wasn't an option to say, wow, this is just so hard. You know, someone dies after childbirth, someone dies of typhoid fever, someone dies of cerebral malaria. Those were the three diagnoses in this case. This is so hard, I would rather be shielded from it and stop. But that's not an option, you know, for those who were living and working in their home country. And so this chance to convert those pretty harrowing losses into more conviction and more effort, they were important to us.
We have those kinds of big memories, and yet, you know, of course, sifting through, you know, what it means. So for me, when I think about certain specific memories, I think about, for example, a place, not the original place where we were in Haiti, but a commune close by where there was a clinic. And, you know, early on, we realized that it wasn't going to be enough for us to simply build a clinic or simply even be involved in training community health workers if we didn't also have some of the responses to the questions asked by the community and the patients, you know, like needing new houses or needing to send their kids to school, the ever-present chant of people living on the margins. And, you know, that I think that was an early lesson for me in terms of, you know, making sure, and this is something, you know, I learned from being side by side with Paul and my Haitian mentors, that you can't apply a different set of standards that, you know, and that's where the complexity stuff comes in terms of, you know, people who say like, okay, well, you know, stick to your knitting or don't get out of your lane or mission creep or any of those kinds of things. And that was when the work became even more enriching. And the example that came flashing to mind actually was you know, working with a group of Haitian doctors and nurses in this commune called Bukankare. And there still is a river there. And at certain times of the year, the river becomes swollen and fierce, so fierce that you couldn't cross it. And so there were people trapped on the other side, and there were women, you know, really literally dying in childbirth. And we work with American doctors, One of those American doctors, Louise Ivers, who's here in Boston and worked in Haiti for a long time, still does, got together and said, well, you know, what do we need to combat this? So that we'd already built ORs on the other side of the river. We need to get a bridge. And I remember a colleague saying to me, you'll never get that bridge built. And it actually took 6 years, but it wasn't because we were able to buy a bridge. It was because of this sort of extraordinary partnership thing that has to happen, including engineers from a university in the US, including, you know, departments of transportation, including the army, the UN.
The Brazilians, I think, gave us a bridge.
The Brazilians, and it was a Bailey Bridge. But, you know, these are the moments where you say, you know, of course it's not going to be a straight line, and of course it's going to be complicated to get a bridge in there. It makes you tired, but it makes you tired in a very good way, in a lucky way.
That's such a brilliant example. And the phrase I hear about both of you is that you pay reverent attention to others and what they need. And that last part, the what they need, is just exactly what you're talking about. That takes you into lots of different spaces.
You know, it's not as if the folks on either side of that river were ineloquent about, or, you know, hesitating about the obvious. That they said, we need a damn bridge. And it was... You know, it was others who would say, stick to your knitting. Is that British?
I don't do bridges.
I don't do bridges. And, you know, Ophelia, I would just add that the doctor you mentioned is Irish, because she would correct you if she were here, but she's here at Harvard and has worked with Partners in Health for a long time. And we're lucky that we have colleagues, in this case in Haiti and elsewhere, who would not say, but that's a ridiculous idea. I mean, in fact, as far as we could tell, the only way to get over a swollen river is with a bridge, I guess, or a raft. I couldn't imagine crossing that in a raft. And, you know, that was the right answer. And by that time, which was Haiti got hit by a number of hurricanes and major tropical storms just before the earthquake, as you know, Frank. And by that time, we had other connections, too. For example, the prime minister of Haiti, she is in the middle of all of her emergencies, and including political emergencies. You know, I remember her emailing us or texting and saying, I'm gonna get that bridge out of that storage. So, and yeah, it took a long time and a number of emergencies. And unfortunately, and we mustn't forget, a number of people died because they really couldn't reach medical services. But in the end, you know, you have to also be able to close your ears to this chorus of complaint and criticism. This is not, you know, this is mission creep or whatever. It wasn't mission creep in the eyes of our friends and colleagues in Haiti. It wasn't mission creep in the eyes of those who needed access to medical services. And so, you know, you had to ask, well, in whose eyes, you know, is this an example of mission creep?
One of the descriptions you provide of Partners in Health is, we go, we make house calls, we build health systems, we stay, which strikes me as such a very clear, concise statement that packs a lot. And I suspect within it, there's a lot of differentiation in terms of your approach from others. Can you go through what's embedded in those seemingly straightforward concepts?
It takes a long time to make a difference, really, with any pressing social problem. At least I can't think of an exception to that, whether you're talking about health disparities or climate change or opening up, like, say, American universities to everyone who would want to study and be good. That those are decades long endeavors. So meaning we're not going to go somewhere and just declare, you know, mission accomplished without having done that mission. We've described that, as have many others, not original, as accompaniment. You know, we're walking with people, you know, not pushing them or trying to lead them. The house calls conceit, the we make house calls part, is also a nod to our colleagues, the community health workers, and families, right? Because the majority of caregiving in the world is afforded by families, your immediate family. And, you know, for someone with any chronic illness to have to schlep into a big teaching hospital or a big hospital of any sort in order to get something that really ought to be made available closer to home. This is one of the big pathologies of the U.S. healthcare system. Where did we learn that? In Haiti and in Rwanda and in Malawi. So that slogan is, you know, I still think it's pretty solid. It doesn't describe all of what we do because we're interested in teaching and learning. That was the idea behind that. I don't know, Ophelia, was that acceptable?
I think it makes total sense, and I agree. I mean, in some ways, that, I was going to say slogan for want of a better word, but it's not a slogan. I think it's much deeper. But in some ways, it's kind of indirectly proportional to our mission statement, which is, you know, is meatier, but really is saying a very similar thing. And, you know, the we stay part is really obviously another way of saying we, you know, don't leave. And it's not that we refuse to leave or will, you know, any of that. It's really in that if you, we will be here for as long as you want us to be here, not when a grant runs out.
Yes, exactly. It's not that project mentality. The other point, which I'm sure, Frank, that you've already gathered, is that, you know, if Partners in Health is a confederation of sister organizations with a Haitian branch and a Rwandan branch, and Navajo affiliate, then why would they have an exit plan? They're from there. So 99% of our team in Haiti is Haitian, if it's not more, towards 100%. And I would just say one other thing, you know, with a nod to our friend Jim Kim, you know, who always reminded us, and as we heard in Peru and Mexico and Haiti, is people don't want to live in poverty. So the big picture intervention is to get rid of poverty. And you know, that requires a series of interventions that are not going to happen largely within hospital walls. And he's been particularly committed to that, not just in recent decades, but, you know, since we were students and first started this endeavor.
Given all, I mean, Partners in Health has expanded so dramatically. You make such an impact now, serving, as I said, to start around 4 million people. With so many needs worldwide, how do you decide to go where you're going next? What's in the future for Partners in Health?
Well, that's an exciting question for us because, and I'm smiling because, you know, on the one hand, it's true. And I was thinking actually with that statement about we go, you know, we are a collective of colleagues now, around about 16,000 people altogether, and yet in a relatively small number of countries, which is the point. We heard for many years, well, oh, you can do that in Haiti because of X, Y, and Z. And then we started working in Peru. Well, oh, you can do this or that in Peru because it's Peru. And it didn't really matter how many countries PH was working in concert with the governments at local and national level. It didn't matter. People would still say, yes, but you can't do it here. And have you tried to do it there? There's actually less of that these days, and there's much more of, would you come here or there? But one of the things that we've been working on now for the last few years, and again, with our original colleagues from Haiti, when we went to Rwanda, when we were invited to Rwanda in 2005, it was with our Haitian colleagues who had the most experience in terms of treating HIV and in building a health system and in training community health workers and in supply chain. So they were the experts. And now we have been working over the last few years to build a university for global health equity in northern Rwanda as a first step in the northern. There's going to be more than one campus. And it is graduated 2 master's classes in global health and has just admitted its first medical school class. And, you know, these answers, and, you know, I'm not an academic, but I am so excited at the idea of, it's not just a medical school, it is a university that applies itself to the entire field of global health equity, of lessening that enormous gap. And that means supply chain, and that means everything that is needed in this, all of these important components that allow people, and that might mean at some point, you know, infrastructure and all of it. That is at least one of the, you know, I don't even want to say answer, because I think it's much bigger than that by saying it's an answer to, you know, the question of how are you everywhere. But I do think it's one of the answers to it.
And, you know, inside an institution like that, or institutions like that, universities, medical schools, nursing schools, there are also serious equity issues. So I know that in this first medical school class, their goal was to have at least 70% of the first medical school classes to be women. And they will have no trouble meeting that goal since they had, you know, thousands of applications, you know, within short order. People are drawn to not only to higher education, but the idea of fairness, justice, equity.
All right, I have two closing, very general questions. First general question. If you could change one thing about how things work, what would it be?
We've been able to accomplish a lot, but I am still, we are having the same conversations at the board level and at amongst ourselves and, you know, with the general audience about the fact that we don't have enough resources to do what we really want to do. And I think, you know, we have loads of generous people who've jumped into this work in extraordinary ways. And yet we know that there are enough resources out there to tackle these enormous problems. And I would say that a frustration for me, I'll never stop, you know, looking for support in all kinds of different ways. But I still feel like, you know, the dreaming big, and one of the things, Frank, at the very beginning when you were talking about Paul's qualifications and titles and things, one of the things that you left off was that he's the chief strategist for Partners in Health. And in order to be...
It's a groovy term. I love it.
It is a groovy term.
I think it comes from Frank's world.
Yeah. Well, it's... And, you know, though, yeah, I would exactly. say that we turn to it all the time. Like, if you have a chief strategist, then you want the strategist to be able to strategize in a visionary way. And you want to be able to make sure that that ability to even, I'd go so far as to say, you know, see around corners and to see what's next. And, you know, look at the ways that we've been able to turn relatively small amounts of money into enormous policy changes and to sort of just, you know, up the way people think that things can be done and what can be achieved together. And I think that's what I'd like to change is that, you know, that we all be allowed to dream as big as we need to without worrying about the bottom line.
And, you know, for once I may succeed in being more pithy than Ophelia. So, you know, a failure of imagination is the most frustrating thing. And that failure, it tends to be on behalf of other people, right? It's not like we can't imagine our own kids going to, you know, university, or we can't imagine, you know, having safe shelter, or can't imagine being spared, you know, a plague for ourselves and our families. So why can't we imagine that for other people who've been shut out of material modernity? Or been in some other ways punished by where they were born or who they were. And that failure of imagination for other people's aspirations is, that's the big one for me too.
I have a final question that's a bit of a meandering question, so bear with me.
It's okay, it's perfect for us.
Paul has described you as exquisitely sensitive to other people's suffering and getting physically anguished about it. And you've described yourself as unfailingly optimistic and said that optimism is the only choice if we're to transcend apathy. And then I think, oh, if optimism is a choice, that suggests that it requires work to maintain the outlook. What are some of the things you both do to maintain that optimism? Are there practices, books, people you turn to? How How do you sustain optimism in the face of all that you see and all the needs that you see that need to be met and just the work in front of you?
Well, in terms of the list you just gave, Frank, I mean, for us, it's all of the above. And we mentioned other parts of that list. Friends, people we care about doing the same work, encouraging each other. For some, it's spiritual practice. You know, it's thinking about, well, what is the meaning of life on this beautiful but uneven planet of ours? I would say just one thing that, you know, I say to students or others or anybody who'll listen, and that is if you stick with something long enough, then one of the things that gives you optimism is remembering what you saw before and seeing that it's addressed. So, you know, just going back to a couple of the examples that we gave, or two of them, in 1983, it was obvious to us that there needed to be a facility that could take care of complex illness and injury. And neither of us had had it, you know, gone beyond. I hadn't gone to medical school, but it was obvious, right? And that was before, you know, start losing people because they don't have access to a hospital. And then you go back there, as I am about to, there's the hospital. Well, that causes good cheer, you know, or Rwanda. Well, the Rwandans told us that you know, you could read, why did the genocide happen, right? How could you possibly understand the genocide if you didn't understand exclusion of folks from healthcare, education, et cetera? You can't, I don't believe. And so just like in Haiti, they're like, we would like to go to college ourselves, or like to become, you know, fill in the blank. Well, there is a university there now. And so again, having recently been there, it's also a beautiful university, I might add. And Ophelia already mentioned, it's called the University of Global Health Equity. That's pretty straightforward. And it makes me remember, and makes other people remember, obviously, the Rwandan people, a terrible, terrible time. And to look around and say, that's not what it looks like now. That's not what, you don't feel insecure in Rwanda now. You don't feel like the government is going to, you know, go after you and encourage people to do terrible things on the national radio station now. So, you know, whether you're looking at any of the places that we've mentioned, all of the places in which we work, you do see progress. And if you don't see it, you need to look harder, you need to read harder, you need to reflect harder, you need to pray harder. At least that's been, I think, very helpful to us.
I would say that there's no question that seeing progress, and at this point, you know, that there's such a focus, Frank, on these days, on the relatively quick solution. There's a sort of romanticization that of an answer that will be fast, for actually to reverse systems that have taken, you know, sometimes centuries to undo. And I think that the eye on the long term is very important. And that doesn't mean, you know, being endlessly patient. It means kind of finding the right balance of patience and impatience, and making sure that the kinds of changes that you are trying to implement are going to be long-term changes, and you're not going to be giving first aid. But they're in, and that's where the complexity comes in. You know, we're thinking about systems and that kind of thing. But I would also say it's going, so you see the progress, that obviously can keep you in the game for a long time. The other thing is to go where the work is. And we have been able to do that since we first set foot in Haiti. If I am ever feeling down about, you know, almost anything, and I visit my colleagues and friends and the work at any one of the sites, I recently came back from Sierra Leone, and, you know, as Paul said, you only have to think back, you know, 20 years and imagine that place in the midst of a civil war, or Liberia, and then cast your mind back a few years ago to Ebola, and now to go there. I mean, it really is an antidote for despair.
That's fantastic. Where would you suggest, for listeners who are interested in what you're doing, where would you point them? Your website, when is the documentary coming out on you? What's the best way for listeners to learn more about you?
No question, it would be the website, which is pih.org. There's loads of stuff on there about the work in different countries, how to get involved. The documentary has been released and will be made available. They are working on a deal right now that will become apparent when it's available. And as soon as it does, and you know, is available for easy watching, then that will be on our website as well.
And I would just add about that film, obviously, you know, we're not filmmakers, we didn't make it. And it's called Bending the Arc, if you hadn't said that. And it is, again, I don't know the details yet about how it works, but many universities, you know, students, you know, I just went to a showing in Toronto with Partners in Health Canada. A lot of people there didn't know about Partners in Health. And, you know, that was one of the purposes of that meeting. But the people who made that film really looked hard for archival footage and worked hard on it. And I think it's a very quick way for a deep dive.
Spent 10 years actually making it all together.
Wow.
And
wow,
it was sort of interrupted by the earthquake. But I think that the, you know, one way, and Paul is right to mention this, if people were interested in doing a screening, I think, again, if someone was to send an email to info@pih.org, someone would respond to that about the way to do that.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for your time. It is absolutely clear why you're heroes to so many. And thank you for the difference you're making in this world.
Well, thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Partners in Health and Ophelia Dahl and Dr. Paul Farmer are amazing. I hope you enjoyed and learned from this show. Again, you can find out more about Partners in Health and about them by going to pih.org. That is pih.org. I hope you check it out. Our show is recorded at Listen Up Studios in Atlanta. Thank you, Greg and Cooper. Editing is by Stephen Key and Score in Los Angeles. And special thanks to our production team of Brian Sabin and Megan Hanlon. Until next time, this is Frank Blake thanking you for listening to and celebrating another crazy good turn.